I'm Sean Graham, and what's oldest news this week is the Rasmussen Residential School Memoir. Rasmussen was a student at the Mohawk Institute in Brantford, Ontario between 1942 and 1947 and wrote a memoir about his experience and the conditions in the school. He wrote this in 1965 following his career in the Canadian military. And in highlighting the circumstances and conditions of the school and what he went through, Rasmussen offered up a very important source on the history of not only the Institute, but a good insight into the residential school system in Canada. And his son, John Moses, has been sharing his father's story since his death in 2013 and will be delivering the next Shannon Lecture at Carleton University coming up this Monday night on November the 3rd at 7 p.m. The title is This Is Not My Story But Yours, the Rasmussen Residential School Memoir, in which John will be talking a little bit about his father, talking about his experiences both in residential school, but also in the Canadian military, his Korean War service, and we'll be reading passages from the memoir. I should note, too, that when I say memoir, I would assume most people immediately think of, you know, a 200, 300-page book. That's not what this is. It is much shorter, but it is very meaningful in what it does say. So certainly would encourage you to come on Monday night, listen to John talk about his father, and you can go out and take a look at the memoir as well. So in advance of this edition of the lecture series, I was lucky enough to talk to John a little bit earlier, and I really enjoyed the discussion. I think you will as well. So here's my chat with John Moses. All right. And John Moses joins me now. John, how are you today?
Very good. Thank you.
Thanks for joining me today as we are talking about your presentation as part of the Shannon Lecture Series coming up this Monday night, November the 3rd, 7 p.m., entitled This Is Not My Story But Yours, the Rasmussen Residential School Memoir. And Rasmussen was your father, passed away in 2013. And since then, you've been sharing his story. And this lecture as part of the Shannon series is part of that journey for you. But before we get into some of the specifics, I'm just curious, could you describe your dad a little bit? Describe like who he was personality-wise? Just what, you know, when you think of your father, what do you think about?
Well, I'll just give you a bit of background concerning the family in general. Like, we're members of the Delaware and Upper Mohawk bands from the Six Nations of the Grand River Territory near Brantford. And that's where both my parents were born and raised, and where the majority of my extended family members continue to live and work. My father was Rasmussen. He was born on the 8th of August, 1932, and he passed away on the 22nd of May, 2013. He was raised at the Mohawk Institute under exceptionally severe wartime and post-war conditions from 1942 until 1947 for the 5 years spanning roughly the time he was eight until, you know, 12 or 13 years old. Following his time in residential school, when he turned 18, he joined the Royal Canadian Navy, and he spent 5 years in the RCN, including Korean War service on board HMCS Iroquois, ironically enough, one of Canada's tribal class destroyers of the Second World War and Korean War vintage. Following those 5 years from 1950 to 1955, he served as a corporal safety equipment technician in the Royal Canadian Air Force from 55 to 65. And it was in 1965 that he left the military altogether to pursue civilian employment with the then Indian Affairs branch of the Department of Citizenship and Immigration here in Ottawa. So that's how the immediate family wound up here in Ottawa. When he joined the Indian Affairs branch in 1965, it was just a few months in advance of an annual conference of residential school principals and administrators that was going to be held. And as a new hire within the branch, his bosses, of course, were aware of the fact that he had been at residential school, and he was asked to commit his thoughts to paper regarding his own residential school experience. So he did that in December of 1965 and produced a fairly concise, it was, you know, 5 or 6 pages in length altogether, a memoir of his residential school experience. So basically writing in 1965, he's recalling his experiences of fully 20 years before, from 42 until 47. And so, you know, that memoir is interesting on a couple of points, including the fact that when it was written, obviously it was written at a time period that predates our current period of national reflection concerning the residential schools and everything else like that. But my father, although he had a tremendous sense of humor, he was very straightforward in his manner. So if you asked him what was on his mind, he would let you know. Despite or notwithstanding the tragic circumstances described in his residential school memoir, he refused to be defined by his residential school experience, although he never hid it, neither did he dwell upon it. And quite aside from those circumstances of his childhood, as I say, he was a decorated naval veteran of the Korean War, an Air Force veteran of the Cold War era, and an accomplished public servant whose achievements included playing a leadership role with the development and delivery of the Indians of Canada Pavilion at Expo 67 in Montreal, which today is widely recognized as being a real watershed in Indigenous self-representation before national and global audiences. So to describe him, I guess he was very forthright in his manner, but with a great sense of humor. And again, although he, notwithstanding his residential school experience, he never dwelt upon it, but neither did he, he never hid it, but neither did he dwell upon it. So
for you as a kid, but then also as an adult, and, you know, as you learn more about your parents and, you know, when you're a little kid, you know, they're sort of these otherworldly figures, but then you grow up and you realize they're human beings too. Like for you, you know, learning about his experience in residential school as a veteran, the role he played in Expo 67 and all the other things he accomplished. What was that like just for you? Like in trying to, you say he never hid stuff, but he always wasn't necessarily the most forthcoming with things. Like how was it for you as his son learning about his life, learning about his experiences? And what was your approach to sort of gather more information and really get to know him and his experiences?
Well, I think, well, growing up as a kid here at home before I struck out on my own kind of thing, it was just, you know, my dad had been to residential school. My mom's side of the family, they had not been to residential school. They were educated on reserve at the on reserve Indian day schools and that kind of thing. So I didn't know any different. I thought everybody probably had at least one parent was at the residential school, or if not their parent, perhaps a grandparent or two and that kind of thing. So we just always, you know, I can't ever remember not being aware of the fact that Russ had been to residential school and that kind of thing. He had the foresight when he wrote that memoir. He actually retained the original typewritten document itself amongst his own things, and he submitted a copy of the paper to his bosses. So that document was always around the house. I can't remember the first time I sat down and read it, but it seems to me I was always aware of it. And when he passed away in 2013, we were going through his documents and papers and everything else like that. We came across the original typewritten document again, and we were of one mind. I mean, like just the immediate family unit, which by this point is my older brother and my mother, we were of one mind that the best possible use towards which it could be put would be for public educational purposes. And this, when he died in 2013, that was all the research was ongoing for the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. So we were able to hand deliver a copy of the document to Commissioner Murray Sinclair and sort of have it read into the record of the official evidence that was being being collected by the TRC and that kind of thing. But growing up, it was just sort of you know, it was common knowledge that Dad had been to the residential school along with his younger sister, Thelma, and an older brother, Elliot. And that's just the way it was. We thought it was, you know, all Indian families had, you know, at least one parent or, you know, several relatives who'd been through the school. So there was nothing unique about his experience in that regard. I guess the only unique thing was that he had actually set his, you know, he had recorded his impressions in the memoir. So,
did you talk to him at all about being like a steward of his story and sharing his story? You talk about finding the document after he passed, mm-hmm. And being of one mind with your siblings and your mother. But while he was alive, I mean, this document mm-hmm. was, you had read it before. Like it wasn't something that surprised you to know that mm-hmm. he had written this. So is this something that like you had talked about of wanting to share that story more widely and continue his story after he passed and do the things that you're doing now?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I think probably during his final year or two, I know for a fact, like the research was underway for the TRC already at that point. And he was actually approached by one of the researchers for the TRC, and they said, look, we've been, we've been going through the archives, both Library and Archives Canada federally, Record Group 10 and all the rest of it, and also the working archives still retained directly within the Department of Indian Affairs and Northern Development. We've come across your residential school memoir that you wrote in 1965. Is there anything you would like to add or clarify or anything else like that? And, he would have taken the time, I'm sure, to reread the document himself. And he said, nope, I wouldn't change a single thing. Anything I have to say about my experience is what I put down in that memo of 1965, and I've got nothing to change. The only thing I would point out, though, is that, and I don't know what prompted him to do this, it's a signed document. It's a hand-drawn map that he produced from memory, and it's dated October the 30th of 1999. So this predates the TRC research, but it's a hand-drawn map of the residential school grounds that he did from memory in 1999. He signs it with his residential serial number, which is number 12 boy. But what prompted him to do that, I don't know. Like in 1999, I was living and working here in Ottawa. I can't recall at that time period that he had been approached, or if he just, whatever moved him one afternoon to sit down and do this map, I don't know. But that's another piece to the puzzle too, because aside from the memo itself or the memoir itself, there's a photograph of Russ and his younger sister Aunt Thelma that was taken in October of 1943, according to the notation in Russ's printing on the back of the photo. A photograph that was taken of him and Aunt Thelma in October of 1943 during one of the once monthly 15 minutes only visiting sessions for brothers and sisters. And that alongside his hand-drawn map are basically there's the memoir, the photograph, and the hand-drawn map. And those three documents together sort of comprise the record of his residential school memoir. We also have a photograph that was taken of him in, I believe it was October of 1965, upon his release from the RCAF. It was sort of the final official exit photo of him upon discharge. And so that I often make reference to that photograph as well, because just the way he presents himself, again, very much the kind of fellow that if you asked him what was on his mind, it's evident just from the way he carries himself that he's got no qualms about telling you what's on his mind, kind of thing. So, but yes, there are certain features of the memoir, like every time I reread it, and I've reread it obviously hundreds of times now, there's some little detail that stands out that I hadn't necessarily picked up on before, some subtle nuance or turn of phrase, and you can tell that there's something behind that. So,
yeah, so we won't get too much into the memoir and its contents, because that's going to be Monday night at the mm-hmm. presentation, and you're going to read some excerpts from it. And so we won't get too much into it, but you mentioned mm-hmm. he was a student at the Mohawk Institute in Brantford. This is one that maybe I'm more aware of it because I grew up in Southern Ontario. That is, I think it was the residential school that was closest to where I grew up. And some of the work I've done as a historian, it's one of the places that I've read about more than others. Okay. So maybe I'm just biased in knowing a little bit more about it than some of the ones, say, out west. But for anyone who doesn't know about the Mohawk Institute, isn't particularly familiar with it, why was that one so, like, one of the bigger ones, I believe, for, across the country? Like, why was it such a main residential school within the system?
Yeah, well, it has the dubious distinction of being the longest running residential school in Canada. Apparently it was in operation in one form or another from 1830 until 1970, so 140 years of operation. It was run on a contract basis, well, originally as of 1830, and for the first several decades of its existence, it was run by the New England Company for Propagating. The full title of this corporation is the New England Company for Propagating the Gospel of Jesus Christ amongst the British, or amongst the heathen populations of British North America. So
that rolls off the tongue.
It's run by the New England Company, certainly by the start of the 20th century. It's basically being run on a contract basis by the Anglican Church of Canada for the government of Canada, and different conditions applied during the different decades of its existence. And this is part of the, you know, the larger story too, is that my father was there from 42 to 47. There were three generations of the Moses family that were at the Mushhole, and that's the name that it was known by within the community. So Russ was there from 42 to 47. His own father, Ted, my grandfather, Ted Moses, was there during the years of the First World War, and my great-grandfather Nelson was there even earlier during the 1880s. So each one of them had a different experience depending upon the decade within which they attended, and different schools in different areas of the country met different perceived needs depending upon the time period, its geographical situation, and that kind of thing. So when my great-grandfather Nelson was there in the 1880s, it was essentially being run as a mission school for likely young men and women from the Six Nations community who were sent there to be educated as Anglican teachers and missionaries, with the intention that they would be sent out west as Canada continued the process of signing the numbered treaties out in what eventually became across the Prairie provinces. So 11 numbered treaties, of course, between 1871 and 1921, and the premise was that you would have quote unquote educated, if not assimilated, Indians from the eastern part of Canada being sent out west to help missionize and settle other Indians upon their newly established Indian reserves as the process of signing the numbered treaties continued from east to west. When my grandfather Ted was there during the years of the First World War, it was essentially being run as a military-themed boarding academy. They were all organized into platoons and companies and that kind of thing, and it was run along military lines. It deteriorated throughout the decade of the 20s and 30s, and my father and his siblings had the misfortune of being sent there at the height of the Second World War, by which time any pretense towards providing the kids with any sort of training or education had largely been dispensed with. They were there to keep the large farm operation going as a contribution to the civilian food production effort on the Canadian home front during wartime, and some of them were actually sent to provide industrial forced labor in some of the factories in Brantford too, because the major farm machine countries had likewise been converted to meet wartime production needs. So, and that's something that's pointed out on my father's map as well. Not only does he point out sort of the crops and the fields and the various livestock pens and barns that are situated on the Mohawk Institute grounds themselves, he also points to the railway siding and arrows off pointing to, for example, Durex abrasives, which was industrial metal finishing, the Cockshut tractor factory, which had been involved in military vehicle production, and the Proctor Meat Packers, which was a slaughterhouse operation. So, you know, and there'd be no reason for him to recall the location of those factories, other than he was sent to them periodically to provide labor there. But anyways, yeah, you know, it's a multifaceted history to the Mohawk Institute, spanning as it does some 140 years. So certainly the conditions of the 1880s when Nelson Moses was there was different from the 19-teens when Ted was there, different from the 1940s when Russ was there. So,
yeah. So as your father is there, as you mentioned, during the Second World War, it's interesting to me that there's this all hands on deck approach to mm-hmm. labor. And, mm-hmm. you know, as you're going through the presentation, or as you're talking with your father, and, you know, you have a heritage history background as well mm-hmm. from your professional life. Mm-hmm. You know, we talk about the Second World War as a total war and everybody's involved. Mm-hmm. And we talk about things like rationing. But this idea mm-hmm. of taking residential school children and putting mm-hmm. them into the war machine in this really forced way, they don't really have a choice. Yeah. Like they're at this mm-hmm. residential school, their parents aren't there. They're, you know, mm-hmm. they're being forced into this material. Yeah. Does that alter the way that you think about the Second World War broadly? You know, there's certainly yeah. narratives about it. The way I think the politicians talk about it mm-hmm. Every year around this time of year, does that change yeah. the way you think about that moment in Canadian history, thinking about the context of your father's experience?
Yeah, well, certainly for me, I'm always thinking about sort of the, you know, the conditions on the Indigenous home front during wartime, because there were things happening on the Indigenous home front in wartime that simply did not appertain to the rest of the Canadian society as a whole. So we're talking about, for example, challenges to traditional political authority, whether we're, you know, and I'm talking about all of Canada's major wars of the 20th century. So whether we're talking about the two world wars or the Korean War, certain things played out in the same, you know, in each instance, you had challenges to traditional political authority happening. You had erosions of the Indian Reserve land base as portions of some reserves are expropriated for wartime uses with the intention that they would be returned at the end of the hostilities. That didn't always occur. And there was actually a portion of the Six Nations Reserve that was used as a practice bombing range by the Royal Canadian Air Force. There was a British Commonwealth Air Training Base at not Dunville, but Jarvis, Ontario, just south of the reserve. That was one of the bomber training bases for the British the BCATP was located at Jarvis, and they used a portion of the reserve of the Six Nations Reserve as a bombing range. So things like that. And then also too, you know, there are all sorts of unanticipated outcomes on the Indigenous home front. There was, you know, the rate of marital breakdown that occurred as parents departed for their own military service, or perhaps to work in war industries off reserve, and as other, you know, elder siblings and potential role models departed for their own military or industrial service. You actually see an increased rate of family breakdown, with an increased number of kids winding up in residential schools during the wartime years. And that was what happened in my father's own case. Part of the sort of the backstory going there was that my grandfather Ted was, I believe he was born in the year 1900. He was a welder by trade. So when the war broke out, he was about 40 years old. He was too old to be sent overseas, but nevertheless, he was eagerly recruited by the Royal Canadian Air Force as an airframe mechanic. And he was sent to some of these training bases around southern Ontario to repair damaged aircraft, because, of course, as training bases, they can be, you know, damaging aircraft with student pilots and with some frequency. So anyways, all that to say, Ted was unwilling to forego his own opportunity to serve in uniform and thus acquire warrior status and veteran status. The mother apparently had some sort of a emotional or mental collapse and was hospitalized. And as a function of that, the three kids comprising my father, Russ, who was the middle child, plus his younger sister, Thelma, and an older brother, Elliot, were sent to the residential school under that circumstance. So anyways, that's what I talk about for unanticipated outcomes on the Indigenous home front during wartime, which by virtue of being status Indian registered band members under the Indian Act simply didn't apply to other segments of Canadian society. You know, and that's the kind of thing I'm trying to dive down into.
Yeah, because one of the things you're going to talk about on Monday is this connection between residential schooling and joining the military. But then your grandfather served in the Second World War in his capacity, as you talked about. You are also a veteran of the Canadian Armed Forces as well. I mean, there is also the family component that service in the armed forces does tend to be generational. There are a lot of children who follow their parents' path through the Canadian Armed Forces, whose their parents fought, like these generational things. So as you think about the connection between residential schooling, his residential school experience, his military service, how do you put that against the family service that that you are now part of this multi-generational family that has service in the Canadian Armed Forces?
Again, like whether we're talking about the two world wars or Korea, and on both sides of the family, both on my father's side of the family, the Moses side of the family, and on my mother's side of the family, the Montour side of the family, they came from large farming families. So that whether you're talking about World War, either of the world wars or Korea, whenever one of these national emergencies breaks out, just by the luck of the draw, there happened to be at least some of the siblings were of military age, and so they volunteer to serve accordingly. And you know, you can trace this back way within sort of the mists of time, I guess, if you're, you know, you're talking about pre 20th century, wherever the circumstances of economy and geography so dictated, all the major powers in British North America, whether you're talking about the French Crown or the British Crown or the, you know, the emergent United States of America, they all sought to include Indigenous allies within their various strategic relationships. So that's something that applies historically, going back to the time of the Seven Years' War and the Revolution, the War of 1812, and even, you know, lesser known conflicts and emergencies like the rebellions of 1837 and 1838, and right up to and including the Fenian raid at Ridgeway near Fort Erie in 1866. There was a Six Nations militia that was rapidly organized to respond to that emergency as well. But by the time you get into the 20th century, the you know, things have changed militarily and politically. But I think it's safe to say that, you know, notwithstanding that we did not enjoy the full rights and benefits of Canadian or British, you know, citizenship during the eras of the two world wars in Korea, we were nevertheless at the very forefront in fulfilling abroad what is arguably that single most onerous and profound obligation of citizenship in donning the uniform and bearing arms against the country's enemies. On the one hand, sort of on the individual level, the argument can be made, and it's true, that for many Six Nations troops individually, they sought the same perceived material benefits as you know, other Canadians, sort of during times of economic depression, that promise of, you know, regular pay and clothing and food and shelter and all the rest of it. But undeniably, there is a political relationship that's certainly part of the popular culture at Six Nations, and it's embodied within the Wampum Belt diplomacy, which is a huge part of the political culture even now, and especially within the Covenant Chain Wampum Belt, for example, this notion of trading and economic partnerships with the British Crown during peacetime and military alliance during wartime. And that, you know, that has continued to manifest itself during the 20th century. And like at Six Nations alone, for example, when the First World War broke out, the reserve at that point was still under the leadership of the traditional political authority, which was the hereditary Confederacy chiefs and clan mothers. And when the war broke out in 1914, they sort of proclaimed that they were adopting a stance of diplomatic neutrality, like the Swiss. And they actually stated that until such time as King George V formally requests our allyship consistent with the ideals of the Covenant Chain Wampum Accord, or until such time as the German Kaiser declares war on the Six Nations Confederacy of Iroquois and allied Indian nations, where, like the Swiss, were diplomatically neutral. But notwithstanding that proclamation being broadcast across the reserve, there were more than 300 Six Nations band members who volunteered to serve with the Canadian Expeditionary Force. So that kind of response was a slap in the face to the authority of the elected, or sorry, of the hereditary system. And like I say, that's why one of the unforeseen outcomes was this challenge to traditional political authority. So you see more than 300 Six Nations band members volunteering to serve during the First World War. Of those, 292 finally ship overseas. And of those 292, there are 38 who don't come back. They're either killed in action, missing in action, or died of wounds or illness. So 38 out of 292, that exceeds loss. Those losses exceed 1 in 10, thus meeting the dictionary standard of decimation. So, you know, it's accurate to say that Six Nations troops of the First World War were decimated in their service to the Dominion government and the British Crown during the First World War. So,
and at this time of year, right, of course, we got Remembrance Day coming up. We had National Day for Truth and Reconciliation back in September. We talked before we started to record about what your father's story and what this presentation that's coming up on Monday, how it relates to the idea of reconciliation and the importance of reconciliation. I think a lot of people talk about it. It's, you know, a word that is used a lot, especially around this time of year. But for you, what does reconciliation mean, and what do you want audiences to take away from this presentation as it relates to understanding the meaning and the significance of reconciliation?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, as an Indigenous person in Canada today, and this is not unique to me, and anybody, any Indigenous person who will hear this broadcast, I'm sure has similar experiences. And I often ask, well, what does reconciliation mean to me as we head towards September the 30th? And my response has come to be that, as far as I'm concerned, reconciliation resides, or the obligation towards reconciliation resides, with mainstream non-Indigenous Canadians, in the sense that it's up to them to reconcile themselves to the true history of what this country actually is. Whereas Indigenous persons and Indigenous families like my own, when to the extent that they're willing to do so, we will provide the truth-telling aspect of the TRC equation, right? So, and that's the role that my father's memoir plays. It, notwithstanding that it was written back in 1965, you know, several decades predating our current preoccupation with reconciliation themes, as the government of Canada still scrambles to contain its liabilities and that kind of thing. It's, you know, Russ's memoir continues to speak truth to power despite the passage of five or six decades now.
And that is going to be the focus of the presentation, part of the Shannon Lecture Series, coming up this Monday, November the 3rd, 7 p.m. at the Dominion Chalmers Center, downtown Ottawa. It's Carleton University, but not on Carleton University campus proper. It is in downtown Ottawa. So do come and check it out. Again, the title is This Is Not My Story, But Yours, the Russ Moses Residential School Memoir. John, for people who are coming, just generally, what should they expect from the presentation on Monday, and what would your pitch be to get people to come out?
Well, I'll be starting off with some, you know, some opening remarks of mine for context, but the greater part of the presentation is that I'll be reading verbatim from Russ's memoir, and the document largely speaks for itself. But right off the top, I do want to say a few introductory remarks just to put things into context and to, you know, pose a few questions to the audience itself, things to keep in mind as they listen to the memoir being recited.
So it should be a wonderful night. If you're not in Ottawa or you can't make it, it will be available virtually as well. You can participate live virtually through the Carleton University History Department, and it will be available afterwards if you cannot make it Monday. But again, if you are in the nation's capital on November the 3rd, this upcoming Monday, 7 p.m., Dominion Chalmers Center, please do join us for This Is Not My Story, But Yours, the Russ Moses Residential School Memoir. So, John, thank you so much for joining me today.
Well, thank you very much for this opportunity, Yahweh.
So there you have it, my chat with John Moses, and I thank him for his time. Again, coming up this Monday night, November the 3rd, 7 p.m. at the Dominion Chalmers Center. This is Not My Story, But Yours, the Russ Moses Residential School Memoir. And with that, let's get right to today's historical headline of the week, which comes from the CBC on September the 30th, 2025, by Justin Chandler. Woodland Cultural Center, ex-residential school turned museum, draws hundreds aiming to learn and share truths. And this article talks about the Woodland Cultural Center, which is in the building that was once the Mohawk Institute in Brantford, Ontario, which opened a little over a month ago on Truth and Reconciliation Day, September the 30th. And the article goes through, talks a little bit about the history of the building, its transformation into a museum and cultural center, as well as the feelings of residential school survivors and their families, is what this process has been like and what their thoughts are as they now revisit this site as a cultural center compared to what it was as a residential school. I should note that the renovation was a long-term project. The building shut down in 2019 and is now open here now 6 years later for these renovations. And if you're in the area, you can go and visit the museum and cultural center. Very powerful story here. Lots of great quotes from folks in the community. And one of my favorite quotes from the piece is from Janice Kantoktha Bomberry, where she calls the preservation of the site a middle finger to a system that tried to wipe out Indigenous languages. So really interesting piece here. It gives a bit of an insight into not only the process, the site, but also the way members of the community are feeling about this, about the Woodland Cultural Center and its opening back in September. So today's historical headline of the week from CBC and Justin Chandler on September 30th, 2025, Woodland Cultural Center, ex-residential school turned museum, draws hundreds aiming to learn and share truths. And with that, I will say thank you so much for listening, everybody. If you have not yet, please do subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, like, rate, comment, all that good stuff helps other people find the show and keeps us growing. Of course, head on over to activehistory.ca. All of our past episodes are there under the podcast tab, plus all the great written material over there on the website. And as always, if you want to let me know what you want to hear on the show, what's oldest news at gmail.com. So thanks again for listening, everybody. We'll be back with you again soon for more What's Oldest News.